Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton, and I have someone. How long have we known each other, Dylan?
Several years.
Several years. We'll just go with several years.
It's different knowing each other in L.A.
It's different knowing each other on the internet, too. Uh-huh. And but we met when you were at CNN.
Yeah.
I think I was at the New York Times, and you were covering media, politics, this, that, and the other. And now you are at MSNBC. You have an incredible newsletter.
Thank you.
That I read every single morning. And we're going to talk about the stuff that you talk about on your newsletter, which I'm very excited about. So one of the things that I enjoy about your coverage is that you're the one that's like, maybe we should think about this in a little different way. And that happened recently with Bloomberg.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. You know, you're aware of this as I am. There is a immense revulsion to billionaires generally. But politically speaking, any time a billionaire gets into the race, gets into the Democratic Party, it seems to fly in the face of all logic about where the party is going, about the enthusiasm that at least up until recently was surrounding Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. There's this notion that if you have made a ton of money, you somehow are just trying to buy the election and it's a fool's errand and you might as well just get out of the way. And what I think in retrospect, there's a conversation to be had about whether or not that's what Howard Schultz was doing. There's even a conversation to be had about whether or not that's what Tom Steyer is doing. When you talk about Michael Bloomberg, you're not talking about a guy who's coming out of left field and trying to insert himself into the political process. You're talking about a guy who served three terms as mayor of New York City and who has dedicated a vast amount of his wealth toward pushing for the very same progressive causes that Warren and Sanders and others care about. So, look, I'm not. That doesn't necessarily mean he has a snowball's chance in hell of winning. Maybe he does. It just seems weird to me to sort of lump the guy in with billionaires and with this demonization of billionaires as though the guy isn't a real political animal, which I think he is.
Well, yeah, I think that the part that I think a lot of people bring up is that, you know, as you said, like AOC was like just another billionaire, and of course everyone is saying the same thing on Twitter, and you know everyone has an opinion on Twitter.
How great it would be if every billionaire was like Mike Bloomberg? If you're a Democrat, you should be praying that every billionaire was like Mike Bloomberg.
No, it's true. And, you know, he's taken on gun issues. He's taken on, he's had his issues, what politician hasn't. But I think you're completely right. And I think that the problem is it's like there's this now carte blanche thing that like all of these rich people are bad. I think a lot of them are, quite frankly. You could go through all 607 billionaires. Is it 607, I think it is now? In the United States, yeah, there's 2,000-something in the world, and it's over 600 in the U.S. And I would probably say if 600 of them are probably jerks, but there are 7 good ones out there, maybe. So here's the thing. The question I have is, when you look at the candidates on the stage that are, you know, Kamala Harris dropped out this week, won't be long before we lose a couple more. Do you think that Bloomberg does have a snowball's chance in hell? You know, given the fact that people want someone who's a little more centrist, it seems that's what the case is, and someone who does have experience, which he does have. Do you think that he has a snowball chance, or do you think that the billionaire thing that everyone says is that's it, it's done?
I don't think the billionaire thing is what will sink him. I think if you look anecdotally, I believe that there is a greater hunger for moderation and centrism than the current debate taking place on cable news would suggest. I I think really with politics, it comes down so much to charisma. I really do. I mean, I'm really a firm believer that this is like this, that the whole primary and general election contest, the policies matter and the policies sort of shape the nation's larger understanding of who these candidates are. I think the biggest thing standing in Bloomberg's way is his ability to get beyond being boring. I don't think, you know, I think his campaign advisors have sort of tried to make the case that boring is what America needs right now. I think he has to find a way to be exciting. I think he has to find a way to get memed. I think he has to find a way to go viral. And with a guy like Bloomberg, who is sort of not that kind of political figure, that is what I worry about more than anything else. Again, you go back to some of these causes he's fought for, and he had, look, he's got major issues. The stop and frisk policy in New York was a major issue. But by and large, he's pushing for a lot of causes that progressives care about. So I think it's more his ability to sell that in the sort of media environment that we live in today and to become a compelling figure, you know, in the culture, in pop culture.
What I think is so fascinating is when you look at the strategy that he has taken already from the beginning, it's like, it's pretty fucking smart, honestly. You know, it's like, I'm going to let these folks thrash it out for a year plus, and then I'm going to come in the way that I'm going to come in, and I'm going to take a completely different approach. It's a financial approach for sure. There's no question about that, but it is also, it could prove to be an incredibly intelligent one that allows, you know, I think, you know, you just mentioned the media world. We live in this time where the news, the attention span of the news is, I mean, I remember when I first started working in this industry, you know, something could land on the front page of the New York Times or, you know, be a breaking news thing on CNN or whatever. And it would be actually part of the story for a week or so, sometimes longer. And now it's gone from weeks to days to mere hours, sometimes minutes. You know, it's
entire news cycles can happen in less than an hour.
But I think those news cycles spread to candidates too, to our attention for candidates and the ones that we're excited by. I mean, you saw it happen with Beto, you saw it happen with Warren, you saw it happen with Buttigieg. You know, and I think Bloomberg probably should have waited another few weeks, maybe. I don't know. But it seems like he is aware of that and that actually could play to his advantage.
I think that's totally true. And I also think, you know, biding your time and seeing how things shake out with the field is not a bad idea, especially with this cycle. If you look back at previous Democratic cycles, when Obama ran in 2008, it was a wide field of Democrats, but over time, there was a great deal of enthusiasm about him and also about Hillary Clinton's campaign. When you look at, you know, Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton, there were two warring camps, but the enthusiasm was very real. You know, I've since moved away from the East Coast. We live in Los Angeles. I've got a little bit of distance on these things. I don't follow politics on the day in, day out the way I used to, but I think that's also healthy in terms of providing some perspective. I look at this field, and aside from Elizabeth Warren up until recently, I don't see a huge amount of enthusiasm around any of these candidates. Most of the time, if you look at these candidates, people are talking about their problems. Is Joe Biden too old? Is he too out of touch? Are Elizabeth Warren's policies actually feasible? Are they actually real? You know, does Buttigieg have a problem insofar as he can't win any support among the African-American vote? If you're Mike Bloomberg and you're sitting back there and you're looking at your own experience, your own wealth, and the lack of enthusiasm surrounding these Democratic candidates, why wouldn't you get in and at least, you know, make a run for it? He certainly can afford to.
Yeah, it's $4 billion is like if you lost a quarter between the couch cushions right now. It's not a big deal to him.
That's the thing is, though, if I could pay a quarter to get into this race, I wouldn't do it.
Oh, I wouldn't do it. If you offered me $4 billion, I wouldn't do it. It just, I had Marianne Williamson on, and she came to the house to do an interview, and it was a Sunday, and she was exhausted. And I was like, where are you off to next? And she's like, I don't even know. I think I'm going here and there. And I was like, where are you living now? And she said, this was all off audio, and yeah. She said, out of a suitcase. And it just looks, and imagine Warren, who's been doing it for a year plus now. It does not seem like a fun thing.
Yeah.
Kudos to the people that do, but not for me.
Yeah.
All right. So one question I have is, so you've been covering media for what, a decade now or more? Not to age you.
Thanks for that.
But the thing
in my head, I'm still like 22. Almost a decade.
The thing that's so fascinating is how much it has changed in just a 10-year period.
Totally.
It has become more opinionated. It's become more visceral. It's become more dividing. And I look at these, at the current media climate, and it is, I work in it, and it gives me the heebie-jeebies. Like,
right.
Do you think that this can ever be, like, turned around and become, you know, less chaotic and less dividing than it is today? Or do you think that the genie's out of the bottle and that's it?
Are you talking in terms of the political
everything,
dialogue
everything
or the,
is
or the
a,
business nature of the media?
All of it. I think it's like you've got, you know, I mean, I was just reading today about Pirro from Fox News is going on, is doing like stump speeches. You know, it's like, that's not news. That's someone giving stump speeches at a Republican convention. Like,
right.
You know, it's like we... the divide between all of these media outlets is a reflection of the divide between this country. And I do put a lot of blame on the media for the world that we live in today. I think, let's take Trump, for example. And I'm about to be the biggest fucking hypocrite imaginable. I was thinking about it this morning. I was driving to a meeting and I was thinking, like, imagine if, like, your neighbor... If all you talked about for 4 years was your neighbor because he didn't cut his grass or whatever happened, right? At some point, your spouse would be like, just fucking let it go, man. Like, it's right. Like, stop thinking. This guy, like, crawled inside your head and is renting out space for free and constantly. And I think, like, I look at the way Trump acts. So, and he... We give him attention for the things he wants attention for. And boggles my mind that we that the industry has not learned that.
Well, yeah, and it's hard because look, the Trump as a phenomenon and certainly as a president is a incredibly significant historical event, right? I mean, it can't that can't be ignored. But at the same time, you know, for the news industry, especially when you start talking about cable news, it represented a lifeline of sorts. I mean, if you think about the way that CNN, and somewhat less so, but my network now, MSNBC, goes just wall to wall on Trump all the time, that is simultaneously a political calculation about the significance of what's happening in the world right now, but it's also just a calculation about what people will watch, which is, if you turn away from Trump or the intrigue of, say, the impeachment hearings or whatever, and you start doing something that has, you know, let's call it a foreign policy story or something else, the ratings, you can watch the minute-by-minute ratings, and the ratings just start to nosedive. And so there's this sort of bubble that's taking place for the media industry right now because of Trump that is keeping all these, you know, keeping these networks and newspapers sort of afloat and even growing in some cases. And the problem with that is that we focus on all of these, you know, going back to 1 hour news cycles, 1 day news cycles, with all of this stuff that just fundamentally does not, oftentimes doesn't matter. I mean, you could leave the news cycle. You could turn off your television. You could stop reading political news. You could go away and you could come back. And the fundamental dynamics wouldn't have changed. There would have been a lot of palace intrigue. There would have been a lot of sort of, you know, Twitter lighting its hair on fire over the latest thing that President Trump did. But at the end of the day, the fundamental dynamics haven't changed. I mean, it's one of the reasons I used to, you know, you were mentioning I've been covering media for almost a decade. I used to cover media and politics. That's not really interesting anymore. Media and politics is just the same story day in and day out. Oh my God, can you believe the president did this? Oh my God, this won't stand. Oh my God, this goes against our values. As if it mattered. And by the way, you know, Pirro or Sean Hannity or Tucker Carlson or Chris Cuomo on CNN. I mean, the audience of people that is actually watching that on any given day is infinitesimal compared to the amount of audience that's engaging with new and more significant media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat. Any given minute of the week.
Right. Yeah, you're completely. I mean, It's like a billion views a day on YouTube compared to 2 million people to watch Tucker Carlson rant and rave about whatever misogynistic, racist thing he's thinking about
And
weekend.
There's this weird, obsession with this sort of palace intrigue and this and the sort of outrage cycle. And just fundamentally, I think the vast majority of Americans aren't paying attention. Certainly more people will watch cable news because there's a storyline there that they can follow along with than maybe otherwise would have if you just jumped around from, you know, X story to Y story to Z story. But at the end of the day, the amount of people that cable news is fighting over is so small. I mean, the combined audience for Fox News, MSNBC, CNN on your average night is less than the population of the five boroughs of New York.
Wow.
There's a country with four time zones that we're talking. You know what I mean? So it's just baffles me.
Do you think that that as you look forward over, you know, the next few years, do you think that Trump comes and goes, God, please let it happen next year, but let's just say worst case scenario, it's another 5 years, whatever it is. At some point he leaves, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think the news, like let's just say a Bloomberg wins, does the news cycle change for that president and that, or is this the new world that we live in and they will find ways for palace intrigue in a new story?
There will always be room for palace intrigue because I think people fundamentally gravitate towards stories. I don't think you can hand people, you know, policy segments on policy or segments on sort of more significant big picture stuff. I think stories and drama matter. I think what I think about more is that people aren't going to be watching this on television. I mean, you don't get the news through television. You get the news through your phone, you know? And so it just,
unless you're my mother-in-law.
Right, exactly. But well, and that, by the way, that's the other thing about cable news. I mean, the audience is the average age of the audience for all three of these networks. I mean, somewhere in the late 50s, 60s. If you're Fox News, I think it's, you know, probably 104. it's not the future. And so, yes, there will be palace intrigue. Yes, there will be story, but you won't be getting this.
But it affects, the five boroughs of New York are the ones that are watching this, you know, watching the cable news cycle and everything. But
it affects more.
It's affected everything. I remember there was a point in time at the New York Times when an editor said to me, watch, you know, the Nightline tomorrow night after we publish the story in the morning. That'll be the, you know, you could literally track a front page New York Times story
to the nightly news. For sure.
And now it's almost like it's kind of the other way around. It's like,
yes,
it's,
we are too often writing on cable, but that's the choice of the president, because the president cares about cable and he cares about his Twitter feed. And so, well, I don't know if he cares about what he tweets, and he cares about cable news. And so, again, it's this sort of strange lifeline. It's like this last gasp for that part of media.
What do you think media looks like in this? There is a clear divide. It's in many respects, it's almost like, you know, football teams. Like, oh, I support this team and you support that team. I'm terrible at sports, so I won't actually name any because I'll probably name a basketball team.
You know, there's so many good sports metaphors in news. Right?
Yeah.
It's a real shame you don't.
Heard about this. somebody recently said, are you going to the, are you watching the LA game? And I was like, Which one? What? Who is it? They actually said the team name. I was like, "Is that baseball?" But it used to be like, okay, well, I like this sports team, you like that sports team. We can disagree about which one is better, and that has happened to media. Like, I watch Fox, you watch MSNBC or CNN or whatever, and I truly do believe that not just cable, but like newspapers, the New York Post versus Daily News, the New York Times versus the Journal, like. That it has become, that you've seen this divide that has happened, and that it has become almost like you are represented by the thing that you read or watch. I have a friend who worked for the FBI who said that if you brought a copy of the New York Times, right when Trump won, if you'd have brought a copy of the New York Times into the office, somebody would have punched you in the face. Like, and it has become like this representation.
So I don't think we are going to, there is this, especially among older generations, there is this sense of nostalgia for the time when we had three networks and everyone paid attention to the nightly news and we had three newspapers and we had this sense that, you know, the famous quote, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And that fundamentally the nation agreed on a common set of facts given any sort of story, and then you use those facts to have a larger debate. And people feel like this time we're living in where what you're talking about, where everything is weaponized, opinionated, contentious, that this feels like an aberration to what used to have been. I would argue that what was from, say, 1950 to, you know, the early 90s, that was actually the aberration. If you look at the history of news going back to the 1850s, right, or the early 1900s, news has often been hyper-opinionated. People took stances. There were newspapers that represented political parties. The newspapers oftentimes represented a constituency or a group of people and their views, and they tried to basically advocate for those views. And the division between, this holy division between the news side and the opinion side did not exist in the way that we fundamentally understood it existing, you know, I would say when you and I were kids. So I think in many ways, this sort of feels like a return to the way that things used to be.
So there was what, this aberration when there was a divide between opinion and news?
Yeah, it was an aberration to say that news was the authority and that it spoke from this sort of, you know, voice of God, middle of the political spectrum. Everything that came out of Edward R. Murrow's mouth could be trusted. I think that was the aberration.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So when I remember when I was at the Times, and I wasn't a reporter yet, I was an art director, and I was in a business meeting, and there was a story we were talking about in our news meeting, and I forget what it was. It was something, an oil story or something like that. And we came out of the news meeting, and there was a guy who had worked at the Times for 4 decades. And I said to him, well, what do you think about that story? Because it was like a big, big story at the time. And he was like, I don't have an opinion on it. And I was like, oh, I know. Come on. Yeah, of course, I know that's the party line. But like, what do you really think? And I kept pushing him. And eventually he looked at me and he said, Nick, I do not have an opinion. I'm a journalist. And I remember being kind of perplexed by that. And it's admirable that he didn't have an opinion, did have an opinion. But we as human beings have opinions, right?
Yeah.
And you can't cover Trump and the immigration policy and not have and see kids being torn from their mothers and not have an opinion and so on. Do you think that we, the next generation of journalists coming up and the news cycle and so on, will embrace their opinions and their viewpoints, or will they try to maintain that somewhat BS viewpoint that they don't have an opinion?
I think you're going to get more people embracing their viewpoints. You're going to get more people embracing their biases and saying, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. There's no reason to fake it. There is no view from nowhere. Personally, I don't begrudge the view from nowhere. I don't begrudge the people who try to be Switzerland or the people who, Doctors Without Borders, right? Like you basically, you don't ask, is this guy an Israeli or Palestinian? You just jump in and you provide healthcare. And I do think at a certain point, one thing you're talking that we're really talking about is that there is a crisis of authority taking place.
Correct.
In media. It's taking place across institutions in this country and I think globally, but is really taking place in the media. And there's this sort of sense of, we don't know who to trust. We don't know who is entirely credible.
It's all institutions. It's not just media.
Yeah. And I think not all people have to do the same thing in media. Some people have the sense that journalism, there's a line that journalism should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that seems to me to be highly weaponized. So anyone who's comfortable deserves to be afflicted. And our whole point is going to be to help out people who are afflicted. Or if you want to do that, fine. But I also think there's room for journalism that says, look, we are living in fascinating times. I want to provide a record of, to the best of my ability, my understanding of what is taking place here. And I want to be dispassionate enough that I don't let my biases cloud the narrative. So I think the ideal outcome in that scenario is acknowledge your biases to yourself, but you there is a way at times to sort of leave that to the side, like your colleague who had worked for the Times at 40 years, and recognize that in your job, in order to do your job the way you want to do it, you actually have to set some of those biases aside.
Or at the same time, I do think that, you know, my belief has changed over the years, and I do think that there are certain issues where you should have an opinion.
Sure.
But, if you and I were covering, Hitler in Nazi Germany, I would hope that we would be like, wait a second.
Right.
This is pretty bad. Like,
But that's just a question about priorities. And I think it's possible to maintain multiple priorities in your head at the same time. And then at some point, you just have to organize them, right? I wish I could work 24 hours a day so I could get more done. I don't feel like there's enough time in a day. When I get home at 6 o'clock, I spend an hour with my kid because my kid takes precedence over my work. So no matter what's going on with work, my kid owns 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., no matter what's happening. There is a point at which the news becomes so something that's happening in politics, in society, becomes so offensive or problematic or dangerous or becomes such a threat to your sense of values or your own sense of the fate of the republic or the fate of humanity, that you just have to prioritize that over your commitment to your sort of nonpartisan approach to the news. But I don't think that means you have to get rid of that
nonpartisan
approach and just have a bias with everything you write.
All right, I want to switch gears for a minute. You have been writing a lot about what's going on in the tech world recently, and you've also been writing a lot about what's going on in Hollywood recently. So I'm going to do the tech thing first because I have a lot of questions about both. It seems like the media shift to tech it's having massive impacts on the growing pains of these companies and so on. And you spend a lot of time not just talking to the people that run them, but talking to people that work for them and so on. What's your sense of, at places like Apple and Facebook and Google and so on? It's the first time I've ever seen the employees be upset by the actions of their bosses. Do you think that has an impact? Like, what are you hearing, like, when you talk to people, on the street about these things?
Sure. Well, the first thing, that context is what happened is that for a long time, tech was a business story.
Yes.
Right? And then it became a political story, really after 2016 with everything that happened with Facebook and the public waking up to what was happening with our data. As soon as it became a political story, the entire thrust of how the tech world was covered changed. And I think that there are employees at all of the companies you mentioned that sort of woke up and understood that they could have a role in sort of either shifting the tone of that discussion or even shifting the priorities of the companies that they worked for. If you talk to the leaders of these companies, I think their first sense is that, and this is often the case when you get a group of employees, activist employees in any company. It's not just tech. I think, the leadership's first sense is this is a very, very small swath of the overall organization. And the vast amount of people who go to work at Facebook or Google or Apple are programmers or developers who are just really excited to be innovating. But at a certain point, the amount of press coverage, you can't block that out. And I think at a certain point, you begin to ask questions about what is our company doing? I think for a lot of folks at Google and Amazon, the question of Pentagon contracts and defense contracts and the way that AI technology is being used for things like that, I think that becomes a real thing. I think it's the biggest problem for Google. I think a walkout.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the question, though. So there's this Alphabet shakeup this week. Larry Page finally left, even though he really left a couple of years ago, and went AWOL. And, you know, Sergey Brin's, you know, hanging off the side of a mountain or skydiving or whatever it is he's doing. and Sundar, who has been running the company under his watch, and I think it would have happened under anyone's watch, because I think the problems were there a long time ago. They just came to fruition while he was there. There's been a lot of problems. Yeah. And I guess the question I have is, does he give a shit that his employees give a shit? Or for him, is it, I'm at war with Facebook right now, and I've, you know, if I lose a few troops along the way, so be it.
Look, I think he certainly cares insofar as it's a PR issue for the company, right? I mean, it doesn't look good to have these employee walkouts. That's a problem that you need to contain. Does he care at the personal level of, does he say, okay, what are these people really asking for and how do we address their problems? Yeah, I think he does up to a point. I also don't think he wants to set a culture where every time a group of employees get upset about something, they all of a sudden dictate the whims of one of the most powerful and influential companies in the world, right? And so I think that my guess is his feelings about the activist employees probably depend on the case they're trying to make on an ad hoc basis.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
You sometimes have the, when I read your newsletter, you sometimes have the complete opposite viewpoint than I would expect. And not expecting anything in particular, just like, you know, when I look at a topic, I've seen you be defensive for Facebook and other outlets. Is it that you want people to see another side of it, or that you genuinely think like the Zuckerbergs and the Sheryl Sandbergs and those people aren't as bad as we all think they are?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think they're as bad as we all think they are, but that's just, I don't think the Beatles are as good as they get credit for. I just think we've beat up on Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg so much.
But they run a company that does a lot of bad stuff that they try not to fix. They ignore.
So there are certainly cases in which that's the case, and that is why they're in the sort of morass that they're in right now from a PR perspective. I think that the tone of the coverage, the sort of tech clash coverage, which has hit Facebook the hardest, it's hit other companies, but really Facebook the hardest, has snowballed to this point where sometimes I think that the foundation for the stories they get written is always assuming that Facebook is going to do the worst, assuming that Facebook is not paying attention to the problem, assuming that Mark Zuckerberg doesn't care. And it's not that I necessarily sympathize with him or think that he's, you know, grossly misunderstood and is in need of greater understanding or in need of some sort of defense. We were talking about how tech has become political. Part of what that does is it creates this dynamic where you have a press that is antagonistic toward Facebook. And I don't necessarily trust that people on Twitter or reporters who are doing the best possible work they can to figure out what's going on inside of Facebook know 10% or 20% of what's actually going on inside Facebook. So my thing is not, oh my God, the press is wrong and Mark Zuckerberg is right. Of course not. He has made myriad mistakes and he's done so many things wrong. But it's a lot of the issues that you know, blue check Twitter seems to think are just really simple.
Blue check Twitter.
like, oh, political ads, just stop running political ads, right? And Mark Zuckerberg comes out with a statement and everyone thinks, you know, oh, he's just covering up or he's not being straight with the American people. No, these things are hard. They're not easy. And by the way, point of fact, Jack Dorsey came out and just said, oh, we're going to ban all political ads. And then a few weeks later, when he actually implemented the policy, it became clear, even to the likes of Elizabeth Warren, that that didn't necessarily benefit the people who thought that they were going to be benefited by those ads, that it, in some cases, that it actually hurt progressive causes to ban ads on Twitter. And so I guess what I'm saying is not, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's right and the press is wrong. I'm just saying slow down and try to unpack and understand these issues and recognize that if you get too swept up in this techlash, anti-Facebook, anti-Google mentality, you lose sight of how complex and nuanced these issues can be.
Look, I 1,000% agree with you. I think that it's the reason I don't work for a startup or run a startup or the reason I didn't found Facebook is because if it were me, I'd be like, holy shit, this is pretty fucked up that people are dying as a result of this thing that I built. Let me bring the stock down to a dollar if I have to fix this problem, you know? Right. And I just genuinely cannot empathize, sympathize, understand a company or people that don't do that. And look, it probably means I'm the worst capitalist alive. But I do think that – if I was if I was doing a podcast every week and people were dying as a result of it, right? I would probably stop doing the podcast or do a different podcast or whatever it was. And I think that it just doesn't make any sense to me that you're seeing this platform that is having such a negative impact on society. At large, like from Myanmar to politics in America to everything, and for you to be like, hey, you know, it is what it is. Like, perfect example is Sacha Baron Cohen had this incredible article.
Yeah, I saw that
last week, an op-ed, and he also gave an amazing speech. But his op-ed was completely right on. He said, if under the rules that Mark Zuckerberg put in place today, if Facebook existed in the 1930s, Adolf Hitler would be able to advertise on there and say we should get rid of all the Jews.
Right. And so here's to me what it feels like is the fundamental point that you're making. Correct me if I'm wrong. There is this profound technological change that has happened through social media and because of Facebook, and it has done. I mean, you can't put the genie back in the bottle in terms of what has changed. 2.7 billion people are now using this service in some way, shape, or form. There is a lot that it has done, which is neither good nor bad, just sort of is, right? I mean, there's been this
communication, like a
telephone. Communication is crazy. The decentralization of power to a degree, insofar as like anyone now with a computer can do something that has the potential to go viral or has the potential to be shared among large groups of people, the ability to organize. The whole way that we communicate has been fundamentally changed. And so it seems to me like the point that you're making is, okay, if you have these side effects, or even let's call them features of the program, and that are detrimental to society, does that then mean that you should shut the whole thing down and let another social media company like TikTok come along and let everything play out there? Mm-hmm. Or should you do what Facebook has done, which has thrown tens of thousands of people at the problem to try and fix it? And I guess my theory is that I don't necessarily understand how just shutting down Facebook.
I'm not saying shut it down. Here's my analogy. Cars, when they first came out, there were no seatbelts. Mm-hmm. There was no ABS brakes. There were no speed limits. I mean, granted, they didn't go very fast. But over time, we have implemented laws that have save lives. Still, 34,000 people die every year in car crashes, 95% of which are a result of human error,
right?
Which you could probably attribute the same statistics to shit that goes wrong on social media. However, yes, we have implemented rules and regulations and to try to avoid. I think if we didn't have seatbelts and speed limits and airbags and you had to have a driver's license and all these things.
Okay, agree with all of this.
But
who mandated that there needed to be seatbelts in cars?
The government.
Thank you.
Well, that's so. But are you for regulation? Or
yes, oh, for
great,
sure.
Great,
wonderful. For sure. I'm for regulation.
But do you think that Trump? Do you think that Zuck and Sheryl and Sundar and all those guys are too?
Yeah, I think they're for a certain kind of regulation because without. Look, I don't think they're as for regulation as they claim. You know, Mark Zuckerberg goes out and says, please regulate us.
Well, he says that because if you regulate them in a specific way, it kills competition.
Yeah, I think there are ways that regulation could certainly benefit Facebook for sure. I think that they actually legitimately want some form of regulation, the regulation they want, hence all their lobbyists. But they want some form of regulation that actually provides some rules of the road so they don't have to keep paying fines and keep running into trouble. And they actually know, tell us what we are allowed to do and tell us what we are not allowed to do. And I think to go to your car metaphor, the thing that frustrates me about the press coverage is it's like, you need to, you know, Facebook is doing X, Y, and Z wrong, and there need to be rules in place to make sure that these things don't happen. And all of that attention is getting put on Silicon Valley, and it's not getting put on Washington. And look, the problem is Washington is relatively feckless. It's not really great at figuring out even what's going on. And by the way, Washington is still trying to regulate things that were happening in 2015 and 2016. By the time they get around to doing anything.
The hearings with Zuck were a perfect example of like, you know, I lost my password for my Facebook account. Can you tell me how to reset it? Like, you know,
how do you turn this thing off?
Says senator who's been there for 50 years. No, I think you're completely right. I mean, I think this goes back to the beginning of this conversation is that, you know, I think that we are in a time period where everything has moved at breakneck speeds. I've said this many times before, but there's research that says in the next 80 years, we will have the same amount of technological change that happened in the last 20,000.
Right.
The amount of technological change that's happened in the last 10 years eclipses the last 1,000. And right. And I think that that all happens, and government is like this, like opioid addicted turtle, like crawling across the floor, like unsure where it's going.
And in a way, by the way, that might be, if you just think about the organism that is humanity, there might be something healthy in the public directing its anger towards Silicon Valley, because I think there's a realization that governments are totally ill-equipped and inept. Mm-hmm. In terms of any change. And the future is really the important thing because, again, government is always going to be playing catch-up and always trying to regulate the past. And I think there is this sense that, you know, if anyone can do anything about this, it is the people who are actually running these companies. But look, I'm not defending Mark Zuckerberg or Sundar Pichai or anything, but these guys have internalized this problem. The myriad problems that they have, from, you know, data collection to election interference, privacy, security. And they have gone out and said, regulate us. They want a certain kind of regulation. But until government steps up, nothing is going to change.
And that's only going to change if the president changes.
And that's only going to change if the president changes.
It doesn't serve
right.
any benefit for Trump for this all to be fixed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
All right, so switching gears one more time, this time to something that I'm fascinated by, which you cover a lot, which is, of course, Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on? I don't understand.
Such a great question.
I don't understand like what the goal is here. What's happening? You've got the merger of Disney and Fox. You've got the, you know, the insane graphs where you see the number of TV shows being made every year now, where it's gone from a few dozen years and years ago to hundreds now. Most of the stuff on, you want to call it television, we'll call it, should we call it television?
We can call it TV.
Is fucking garbage.
Yes.
Right? I literally, there are so many nights I go up and lay down and I pull up the TV and I go through every single app and I'm like, there's nothing to watch.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's terrible. and yet there's billions of dollars being poured at it. You've got, you know, Warner Media and this and that and the other. Like, what the hell is happening?
Well, so this usually gets...
And what's the goal?
Yeah, I mean, it usually gets filed under the streaming wars, right?
Yeah.
And in a sense, the streaming wars are real because this... this proliferation of content means that these companies are fighting over the best talent, the best stories, the best intellectual property. But a lot of these companies are actually not at war with one another because they actually have different goals. So when you ask the question, what's happening for Netflix isn't necessarily the same thing as what's happening for Amazon, isn't necessarily the same thing as what's happening for Disney or Comcast or whatever. But what unites all of those things is there is this recognition that in order to keep consumers in inside of their worlds, right? In order to keep consumers inside the world of Amazon and Amazon Prime and everything that that offers, or in order to keep consumers inside the larger world of Disney and going to theme parks and things like that, that you have to have creative content. And you have to have enough creative content that people are willing to pay $4.99 or $9.99 or $14.99 a month in order to get your service. And so...
But is the goal, like, why is Apple doing it and Google not?
Yeah, great question. So Google is, I mean, Google's fundamentally in the internet business, right? And so they've got YouTube. And in a way, by the way, in a way they are, because they have YouTube TV, which is like $54.99 a month. $54.99 a month, but it gives you television.
Got it.
Right, oh, it gives okay, you, you know it. What
yes,
I mean?
Yes, yes, yes.
But in terms of the creative game, I think, you know, for Apple, I think what they understood is iPhone sales, which is the bulk of their business, are going down. I mean, they've sort of hit a threshold. And maybe if Apple can figure out a way to create a truly revolutionary new phone, then they can just get back to focusing on the phone business. But short of that, their business is shifting towards services. Apple Music, Apple Card,
Apple Pay,
Apple Arcade, which is games, which is a really big growth area for a lot of these companies. And so having a creative content piece of that, which basically says, sure, you could get your programming on Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu or whatever, but you're only going to be able to get this great programming here, is going to incentivize more people to either stay in the greater Apple universe and keep getting iPhones instead of Androids, or to come over to the Apple universe and become iPhone subscribers. And I think I wrote this a few weeks ago. I could be totally wrong, but I think at some point Apple is going to move to an Amazon Prime model where you pay one fee a year and you get access to everything that Apple has to offer, including upgrades to your iPhone every time a new iPhone comes
Smart.
Out.
Smart.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to pay $49.99 for a case that costs them 12 cents yeah, to make.
That's absolutely right.
Do you think that for Amazon and Netflix, which are kind of at the center of the streaming wars, do you think there's a winner in these games? Like, or is it just that all ships either sink or rise? Or
not all ships? I think, as John Stankey, the head of AT&T's Warner Media, said, I think he said about five or six companies probably get a seat at the table. And that's in terms of the big people who are trying to offer you a broad swath of content. There are going to be a lot of niche players that, you know, if you're really into yacht races or if you're really into dog shows, right, you can subscribe to that service. But at the high level, look, I think Disney is obviously a player because of the intellectual property they have.
IP's,
I mean, it's crazy. And by the way, it's not just that they have a library. they came out with their first show and it was an immediate hit. I mean, everyone is talking about Baby Yoda, right? From The Mandalorian. So Baby Yoda, if they could figure out a way to actually get it on shelves, would be like the Christmas toy, you know, of the season. They to me are the safest. They're actually the safest bet. And I say that as the father.
Oh, I completely agree.
I'm the father of a 2-year-old.
I remember I was at the Times in 2010, I thought 2009, and I cut my cable. And I wrote a piece about it and it explaining how I did it. And back then it was not easy. Like you had to have like an Apple computer hooked up to your television through like, you know, 17 cables and like a wireless mouse and like, you know, and you're using like an app called Box, and it wasn't even an app, it was just a browser. And I remember it was like the top of the most emailed list for weeks.
Yeah.
Because everyone wanted to do it. And the problem was I kept getting all these emails. This is 10 years ago. And the emails were, hey, I did this, but I can't get sports.
Yeah.
And that was always, for years, that was always the thing. And of course with Disney, you do. You get ESPN.
You can get ESPN Plus. If you bundle, you can get Disney Plus for an incredibly cheap price, given all the content that you get. And then you can bundle it with Hulu and ESPN Plus, and now you're talking about sports. Now, it's not all the sports, and we should talk about sports too, but...
Oh, God, you're scaring me.
No, it's actually... Because this is the whole future of where the so-called streaming wars are going. Sports is going to be a really important part of that, because right now the sports rights are owned by the broadcast companies, but at a certain point... they're going to all come up for auction in 2022, 2023, and you're going to have Silicon Valley players, tech players, phone companies moving in and trying to take a greater piece of that action.
But the question I have is, why wouldn't the NFL or whatever, why wouldn't they be like Disney Plus and just have an app everywhere and be the ones that own all that stuff rather than have to go through another platform?
That's actually a great question. I would say probably because of money, just because if you license it, the more licensing deals you have, the more money you're going to make. So if you do it yourself, you have to create this whole business around it, and then you have to advertise around it. And meanwhile, there are all these players out here who are going to pay you insane amounts of money. I mean, the amount of money that media companies are spending on sports rights is mind-boggling. And I've talked to executives at sports media companies who have said, yeah, these prices are too high, but we don't have a choice.
What are they spending on them?
I mean, I'd have to look it up. But it's just... It gets higher and higher and higher every single year.
When you look at why there's so much stuff out there and there's so little good stuff, what do you attribute that to?
You know, there's a media executive here in Hollywood, actually, who told me once, there are different analogies. One of my favorite ones is, if you look at the U.S. Open, right, or any tennis tournament, and you say, or a golf tournament, and you say, okay, we're going to invite 100 people to play. You know who the 7 or 8 people are who are capable of actually winning the tournament. So then you say next year we're going to invite 200 people to play. But it's still the only 7 or 8, maybe 9 people now who are capable of actually winning the tournament. And so just because you create more content doesn't mean that there's more better content. One of the great stories to sort of bring everything we're talking about together in terms of, you know, the rise of Silicon Valley and the changing nature of media generally is there's no real algorithm. There's no sort of technological innovation you can create to figure out how to put together a really great piece of creative content. I mean, you know this. You're a screenwriter now. Like, you have to have the right screenplay. You have to have the right talent on screen, you have to have the right director, you have to have the financing behind it. Things got to go right. If you're shooting a movie, you got to pray that maybe, you know, you're getting the right weather on a... I mean, there's a lot that goes into making creative content, and there's no silver bullet towards sort of figuring out how that works and then just replicating it over and over again. Now, you can do it up to a point. Bob Iger has done that at Disney. Every Disney story is practically the same story. How many Marvel movies exist now? 40? And people keep going to see them. But at a certain point, if you want to come up with the next great Game of Thrones, there's no formula for doing that. And so it's hard. It's really, really hard.
Yes, but I totally 1,000% agree with you, and I will say that screenwriting and TV and film and all is without question the hardest form of storytelling there is, with harder than books, magazines, anything. But when you look at, like you just said, you know, how many, there's 40 Marvel movies and they're all the same. Like, when you look at that, you have to, there's a statistically, there back in the 80s, Hollywood execs were trying anything. Like, you know, they were trying different forms of storytelling, different kinds of movies, different kinds of TV shows, and so on. Now, that happens so rarely, like a Booksmart or something like that that comes out, or a Parasite or something. It's like an anomaly that something like that gets made, because it's a gamble, and they think, oh, well, if we do, you know, Yoda 17, people know that brand, they're gonna engage with it. And it seems to me that a big part of the reason there's so much shit out there is because even these innovative outlets from Silicon Valley are still afraid to try something new.
Yeah, that's a part of it, and we are living in a time where we are grossly over-indexed on sequels, prequels, remakes, different versions of the same Marvel movie, and that is frustrating. At the same time, I would argue that one of the reasons that there is so much shit on these streaming services is there's not, if you're Netflix and you are trying to just feed the beast of original content, especially because now all these other streaming services are taking back their content, so you need to have more and more and more original content, you are taking less care to create something that is really high quality. And so, you know, it's like, you know, when Richard Plepler was the head of HBO, he was in this incredibly privileged position where he could take time to really sort of, you know, cater to the creator of a show. He could be patient. He could wait for something to work. He could invest a lot of money in it. If you're Netflix and you're just throwing money at things and you're constantly cycling through things and you're launching two or three different shows on the same day and your own shows are competing for marketing, it just becomes this thing where you will necessarily churn out a lot of shit content. And frankly, I have the same experience. I go into Netflix, I browse around for 8 or 9 minutes, and I'm like, there's nothing here I actually want to watch. And then if I actually do like to watch something, unless it's like a really big bet like The Crown or Stranger Things, there are a lot of movies where I'm like, what? Did you put any energy into actually making this look good? Did you think about the production value? I mean, sometimes it feels like that, you know, I'm gonna like see the light, you know, the lighting mechanisms or the boom mic is gonna come down in the shot. It's so bad.
Do you think that that those outlets like Netflix and so on will change, or is this just who they are?
I think they will continue to. I mean, Netflix is very specific because theirs is a scale play. They're basically trying to replace television, which is they have to just keep churning out all that content. And so I think they will continue to make high bets and low bets. And they'll basically, you know, I don't know the gambling metaphor, but they'll have a lot of low cost things that they'll sort of put out there into the market that aren't totally high quality, but maybe they'll catch on with enough people and they'll become a sensation, or maybe they'll feed just enough people or give just enough people a reason to keep subscribing to Netflix. And then they'll have these really big things that, you know, are their sort of message to the world that we value quality content. The Crown is an example of that. What they're doing with films like The Irishman, with Roma, that's an example of us saying, look, we are willing to invest in quality content. The problem is if you are in Hollywood and you're a content creator, you don't know, unless you're Martin Scorsese, that if you go to Netflix, you are going to get all that tender, loving care. And I think that's why, you know, people will value something like an Apple TV or even an Amazon that might have a little bit more time to provide a little bit more of the, you know, the sort of finesse that goes into making really great quality content.
All right. So we have a couple of minutes left. Just to bring it back to the beginning.
Yeah.
You think Bloomberg's going to be the nominee? You think it's Buttigieg? You think it's Warren?
See, here's what I know. There's one thing I know.
This is just a total close your eyes and throw the dart. So,
Yeah, but see, the great thing is that any time I've tried to make a bet on how the future is going to pan out, specifically in terms of political races, I have been woefully wrong.
Okay, so who do you think is the least likely, and then we'll pretend that that's the person who...
Well, I don't think, I don't think Andrew Yang is going to be the nominee.
But I think he'll have an impact.
He'll definitely have an impact, and it's important that he's there, and he might get a cabinet position. There are always, with every political race, there are the people who you can tell are actually running, and then there are the people who are running for cabinet positions. I don't see Bernie Sanders being the nominee. I just don't.
I
think he had his time, and I think if you are in, if that is where you fall on the political spectrum, why wouldn't you go for Elizabeth Warren? Joe Biden, you know, he's the most popular. He's been there before, but he has serious problems, and frankly, it's not that he's old; it's that his age is showing. And I think that is going to be a very big issue for him, and it has been an issue on the debate stage. You know, Pete Buttigieg, I think he could be, and at the same time, maybe he's not. You know, he's young, he doesn't have the Obama level of charisma, so maybe he can't sort of cross the finish line with that. And then getting back to Bloomberg, I do not rule Bloomberg out, and I didn't. You know, I will get pilloried for that by some people because I didn't rule Howard Schultz out either, and that was idiotic
Howard Schultz was he was an asshole in the way that he went about it. It was not a smart campaign. It was not a smart campaign, and it was entitled, and I think the difference between Schultz and Bloomberg is Schultz was like, I'm running as an independent, and I don't give a shit if it costs us Trump, I'm going to do it anyway. Whereas Bloomberg was like, I'm actually going to run as a Democrat, and therefore I'm not going to risk.
This is, I think, part of the aversion that people have when billionaires get into the race, is they think that basically, and they're not wrong to think this, is that said billionaire has been sitting in a room of yes men and thinks, oh my God, I ran a company so successfully, wouldn't I be a great president? And then everyone in the room is like, yeah, you know, you really would be, Howard. You'd be great. And there aren't the people around them to tell them the way that this actually works, all of the roadblocks that they're going to run up against, what the actual mood of the country is. The difference with Bloomberg is he has done the research. He did so much research that back when Howard Schultz was getting in, Bloomberg said, this isn't the right time. I think he's seen the way that the race has changed. I think he's seen the lack of enthusiasm around the Democratic field. And I think he thinks that there could be an opening. And so I don't know if Bloomberg is going to be the nominee, but I don't rule him out. And the one thing I know is that if you had asked people whether or not Obama was going to be the nominee in 2008 or whether or not president in 2008, or whether Trump was going to be president in 2016, everyone would have told you probably not.
Likely not, I think was the special. I mean, for both of them, yeah.
Yeah.
They were the long shot. So anyway, it will be interesting to see. Can you tell people where they can get your incredible newsletter?
They can. It's at nbcnews.com/buyersmarket. And this is where you have to know that my last name is spelled B-Y-E-R-S. Market.
Not B-U-Y.
Not B-U-Y-E-R-S. Dylan, it sounded really good when you could see it, but then when you have to tell people about it and there's no visual aid, it becomes sort of harder.
Well, I always have to people, whenever I'm like on the phone with someone and I say Bilton, and they're like, Hilton? And I'm like, no, Bilton with a B.
I'd stay at your hotel.
The Bilton Hotel. This episode brought to you. Dylan, thank you so much. This is
a
fascinating
Nick,
conversation.
I appreciate it.
Thanks to my guest today, Dylan Byers. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That's me. You can find this on ApplePodcastRadio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thank you, of course, to my sponsors this week, Mother Hacker, Away, Figs, and Once Upon a Time in America. Please support them all the same way you support this podcast.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.